Welcome to the Art Talk podcast, where I tell the stories of art, artists, and interview people in the arts. I am Karin Merks, your host, and I am an artist, art historian, teacher, and mentor. This is episode 97 of Art Talk and part 2 of The Gaze Reclaimed. We look at two powerful strands of art history that have long been intertwined. How, for centuries, women's bodies were shaped, controlled, and violated through visual culture, and how one exceptional artist, Artemisia Gentilici, radically altered that legacy from within the canvas itself. To begin, let's consider how culture has historically seen and unseen women. In her incisive book, Women in the Picture, What Culture Does with Female Bodies, art historian Catherine McCormack takes us on a journey from the Renaissance to the present. She reveals how women were not only idealized in art by the male gaze, but also subjected to it, depicted in scenes of sexual violence and domination, often painted as beauty, mythology, or divine will. One of the examples McCormack unpacks is Titian's The Rape of Europe, 1560-1562, created for the King of Spain, Philip II. The painting portrays the abduction of Europe by Zeus, who appears as a bull. This myth, drawn from Homer's Iliad, has long been interpreted as a tale of divine desire. But McCormack shows us what lies beneath. Zeus' conquest is not just romanticized violence. It also serves as a political metaphor for imperial expansion. Philip II saw himself as a kind of 16th century Zeus and commissioned artists like Titian to mythologize his power over Europe, Africa, Oceania, Asia, and the Americas. These visual myths weren't just cultural flourishes, they were tools of control. And while these images often idealized women, they also sexualized and visually abused them. Many of these so-called masterpieces were, in truth, a form of sanctioned pornography, erotic fantasies dressed in allegory, reinforcing power structures and patriarchal privilege. As McCormack argues, these legitimized sexual violence through myth and aesthetic, making dominations appear divine. The painted bodies of women became sites of pleasures, conquest, and possession, not just for the viewer, but for the systems those paintings upheld. But McCormack reminds us, women did not always accept this cultural positioning. Some resisted. And among the most compelling of those resistors was Artemisia Gentilici, a woman whose art confronted the very system that tried to define her. Born in 1593 to Orazio Gentilici, a Tuscan painter, and Prudencia Montoni, Artemisia grew up in her father's Roman studio. Her father, deeply influenced by the stark realism of Caravaggio, taught her not just how to paint, but how to see. And Artemisia absorbed this bold chiaroscuro style and made it her own, becoming the only recognized female follower of Caravaggio and one of his most original heirs. Yet, her story is inseparable from violence. While still a teenager, training in her father's workshop, Artemisia was raped by Agostino Tassi, a friend of her father and her tutor. What followed was a harrowing trial in Rome, which details so painful they remain difficult to read today. The transcripts of that trial, preserved and available through institutions like Tate, reveal a young woman subjected not only to physical violation, but to public scrutiny and humiliation. And yet, Artemisia did not allow this trauma to define her. In 1610, at the age of just 17, and before her assault, she painted her first major work, Susanna and the Elders. The biblical story tells of Susanna, a virtuous woman, being leered and blackmailed by two elders who threaten to accuse her of adultery unless she sleeps with them. Susanna refuses and is condemned until a young man, Daniel, exposes the elders' lies. Early depictions of this story often indulged in eroticism, with Susanna shown as a passive nude, a victim to be looked at. But Artemisia's version is different. Her Susanna recoils uncomfortably and vulnerable, twisting away from the two men. The painting radiates empathy, not titillation. It's been suggested Artemisia may have studied her own body for the painting, and the result is deeply human. And while this work predates her own ordeal, it foreshadows her capacity to express women's resistance and dignity under pressure. To be a female artist in the Renaissance, and indeed for centuries after, was to be scrutinized not just for your talent, but for your character. Patrons judged moral virtue as much as skill. Yet Artemisia did not shy away. After the trial, she married the painter Pier Antonio Steatesi and moved to Florence, then Naples, building a successful career and forging connections with artists, patrons, poets, and musicians. Galileo and Michelangelo, to name a few. She was more than just a painter, though she once claimed she could not read or write. Her surviving letters and poems show a woman deeply engaged in the cultural world around her. She corresponded with thinkers, contributed to literary circles, and moved with confidence through intellectual salons. One of the most iconic works associated with her is her 1630 self-portrait, now in the Palazzo Berberini. It is only confirmed self-portrait she created, but across many of her paintings, religious, mythological, and allegorical, she used her own likeness. She depicted herself as Judith, as Mary Magdalene, and as Cleopatra. These were not self-portraits in the traditional sense, but rather strategic insertions of self into powerful narratives. By embodying these roles, Artemisia blurred the lines between artist and subject. She reclaimed the right to be seen, not as a muse or passive figure, but as agent, actor, and author. In Self-Portrait as a Lute Player, for example, she appears in a lavish costume with direct eye contact. The theatricality is deliberate. She's not merely dressing up. She's engaging with the literary, musical, and performative cultures of her time. Her gaze confronts us. It is a thoughtful knowing. It is a woman crafting her own myth. In her later years in Naples, Artemisia was celebrated by poets who honored her talent, not her past trauma. They wrote about her artistry, her intellect, her place in the world of refined conversation and courtly exchange. Her identity as a rape survivor was not erased, but it did not define her career. Instead, she defined herself. So what can we learn from Artemisia Gentileschi today? We learn that the gaze can be reclaimed, not just resisted. Artemisia didn't simply reject the male gaze, she rewrote its grammar. And through her strategic self-representation, she transformed the act of looking into an act of power. She showed us that self-portraiture can be sovereignty, that painting can be a form of memory, of resistance and self-definition. And now, I offer you this small invitation. Stand or sit in front of a mirror. Look at yourself, and then sketch for just 5 minutes. Your eye, your nose, your mouth, whatever appears to you. And then ask, What story do I want my face to tell? Next week on our talk, we continue exploring the gaze reclaimed, turning into the theme of sovereignty through the work of another remarkable early modern artist, Elisabetta Serrani. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share with your fellow art lovers. You can also sign up to receive a free guide. Just follow the link in the comments. Until then, keep looking, keep questioning, and keep reclaiming the gaze. I wish you a very peaceful and productive week. And remember, art is the cradle of your soul. Take care.